On Saturday evening, August 8th, one of Cincinnati's treasures will be honored at the Cincinnati Blues Fest. Philip Paul, who was a session drummer at King Records and a great jazz drummer as well, was born on August the 11th, 1925. Philip Paul's musical career spans decades of performances, beginning in Harlem, where he played with jazz greats such as Dizzy Gillespie, Bud Powell, and Sonny Stitt. 3 days before his 90th birthday, he'll be in the spotlight at 7 p.m. Saturday, August the 8th, on the Arches Boogie Piano Stage for his long, distinguished career. Philip, thanks for coming in tonight.
Thank you.
Let's go back in time a little bit. It was Tiny Bradshaw who brought you to Cincinnati from New York City as a young man. That was an amazing jazz scene to get your career started right there. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. I was working at the Savoy Ballroom, which is was a super establishment for music. They would have like a big band and a smaller band, maybe 8-9 pieces. And I was working with Buddy Johnson, a big band who traveled on the road. He used to come to Cincinnati quite a bit, by the way. And Tiny Bradshaw, on one of my breaks, he came over to me and he offered me the job with his band. You know, he said his drummer was likely to leave in several months and he would like for me to join him, only I would have to come down to Cincinnati. So, you know, I listened with one ear and closed them out with the other because musicians have a bad feeling about leaving New York. You lose all your connections and everything. But I told him, sure, if you call me, I'll join you. So I went home with my parents at the time. I mentioned it to them, and we never talked about it again. And ironically, about 6-7 months later, he called me. And what urged me to really to try this, I wasn't working then.
That'll do it, Warren. So he called, and then what?
And I told him, I said I got a few things I got to tie up. That meant I had to go to my parents and tell them about it. And I had mentioned it to my mother. My mother said, my parents were from the Caribbean, and, you know, they migrated to this country, and they had certain ideas about things. So my mother said, do they have running water down there? What is it? How you pronounce that? My father says, what kind of city is that? I told him, Ma, Daddy, it's just another city. I'm going down to join Tiny Bradshaw. They said, well, okay, if, you promise me you take care of yourself. And so I got up my old set of drums, and I had a big bass drum, you know, about 26-inch bass drum, and got on the Greyhound bus.
With your drums?
My drums, suitcase, you know. And I had traveled on the road in New York. What I mean travel on the road, like on the weekends, we would go down to West Virginia or something like that and play, you know, but no long-distance traveling like this involved. So I got down to Cincinnati, and he told me that when you get down to Cincinnati, go to the Cotton Club. And the Cotton Club was some kind of club. By the way, it was located in Cincinnati at 6th and Mound, not Newport.
And what was the music scene at the Cotton Club?
Fabulous. Bands like Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Jimmy Lunsford. All those people would come in. All the bands that were in this area would try to get booked in the Cotton Club because it was that famous and was that well-known and well-attended. You know, they used to have breakfast jam sessions where people come from all over the city. They had a red carpet. They rolled the red carpet out. They had a doorman that would assist people into the club. It was interracial all the way, even though we hadn't quite got to civil rights yet. It was just totally integrated, no problem. People came to hear the music, and that's it.
That was the music scene there. What about the safety scene being at the Cotton Club?
Well, it was in a black neighborhood, for one thing. And, you know, some people have conceived ideas if you go in a black neighborhood, you're going to get murdered. That wasn't the case. You know, I think the situation now is worse than it was then because a lot of people weren't carrying guns at that time. You know,
right. I mean,
it wasn't prone to violence at a drop of a hat. You bump into somebody, you said, excuse me, and you moved on, you know, didn't create problems. Other than known prejudices that existed, not only here in Cincinnati, but all through the South, it was just normal.
I know in 1952, that was the year you first met Sid Nathan at King, mm-hmm. and you started working there in Evanston as a session drummer. Mm-hmm. And I certainly know it as primarily a rhythm and blues house, but there's a tremendous amount of country recordings that came out of there.
Yeah.
Give us an idea of what a typical workday at King Records looked like.
Well, I know this story's been told before, but I have to start there to get into it. Sid told me one day, he said, I got a backlog of country recordings, tapes. Somebody gave him the idea, one of the A&R men gave him the idea, you can try to bring these up to date if you get Philip to dub in a drummer, you know? Just put on the headphones, listen to the tape, and just use your own imagination and put in a drum beat that fits. I did that for months.
That's a little bit upside down. Characteristically, yeah. If you're going to bring musicians in and do overdubbing, you and your guys are going to go in first,
isn't right.
the drums and the rhythm section, and then do everything else.
Well,
so what was that like to do that upside down?
Sid was a little different anyway. You know?
Right. So,
and it worked because it was fun to me. You know, I had no idea of what he was going to do with them, but he sold them.
Let me ask you this. Those tapes that you're referring to, they were recorded with a country western band without drums. Is
right.
that correct?
They did not use drums
right.
up until that time,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I had to come up with something that, just whatever I thought of, you know, whatever made it smooth and swing. I like to use the word swing because of it, that old thing that Duke Ellington said, if it doesn't swing,
Don't mean a thing.
It's got to swing, yeah. You know?
And a challenge that would be, because the original tracks were recorded in those days. There was no click track or nobody keeping time.
So, that's right.
So those finished recordings were kind of wandering up and down and faster and a little slower. And you got to try to fit your work in there.
Yeah.
Quite a challenge.
I just had to stay with it and just make a strong, sturdy beat, you know.
So for you said several months, that's what you did. You'd get up every morning and go in there, put on the headphones, and add the drums to all that background.
When we didn't have a session of our own to do, you know. Sometimes I would come in early in the morning. Sometimes I'd stay late at night. But my job was full-time.
What about a typical session kind of a day, like you're working with an artist? What did that look like?
Oh, it depended on the artist. Now, there were some artists that, we'll call them that, but they had trouble remembering the lyrics. They would have trouble hitting the notes. And especially with doo-wop singing groups, instead of one person singing or two, you had maybe five or six.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have trouble. So there were certain groups that we did not like to record with, but that was our job, to make a nice background, a cushion for them to sing.
Tell us about the drum kit at King Recording. Was that your set, or was that a studio set, or what did that look like?
Sid had an old bass drum there. The drums were in horrible shape when I came. And I worked with them. You know, I put a blanket in the bass drum. I tuned the snare drum. You can tune the drums. I do this when I go into schools and I talk to the kids. I said, when you open the box with the drums, you just don't set them up and start playing. You have to tune them to a certain degree. You know, it has to be some kind of tuning. And I usually tune my bass drum to C, the lower octave C, and then I tune the rest of the drums to higher C, just to keep them in that same pitch. And you'll hear it say, bing, bing, bong. If you hear sound like that on all your drums, that's going to come out sounding good on a recording or when you play. Tune it in a relationship to see all your drums. And that's what I did with the studio drums. And we have developed a unique sound on the drums. Sid never wanted me to change. I told him one day, we need a new bass drum. We need a new snare drum. He said, no, we'll lose that sound. He wouldn't have lost it because I could have tuned him the same way. See, but, you know, he went along with that. I went along with that.
Maybe Sid didn't want to spend the money to buy a new drum.
That too.
Listen, I'm a huge Freddie King fan, and his influence on contemporary guitar, electric guitar players of today, and I'm just not talking about blues players or rhythm and blues players. He passed the torch, if you will, to Eric Clapton. I mean, directly. If you want to listen to Freddie King's work at King Records and listen to, particularly to Eric Clapton's early work with John Mayall, you're going to hear that he spent a lot of time listening to Freddie King. And of course, then Eric kind of laid out the track for everybody else's rock and roll and blues playing and so forth. You played the Hideaway session, isn't that correct? Do you have memories of that?
I made most of all of Freddie King's recordings here. And he was one of the most enjoyable musicians that I've ever recorded with.
Tell us about Freddie.
Yeah, he would come in and he's a jovial kind of guy. He made you feel good. You know, you wouldn't feel nervous because he wasn't that kind of guy. He'd take out his guitar right away and start playing around with a tune. And then he'd get up and walk in the corner, like different corners, to get the right kind of sound that he wanted, you know. And we didn't know what he was doing, but musicians do odd things. Then he'd start playing a tune. It was so infectious that I would start playing the rhythm to it, you know, just he and I. And then Freddie Jordan, the guitar player, would play some chords. And before you knew it, we were playing the tune. So Freddie King would say, "That sounds good. Let's record it right away." We did Hideaway. We did Hideaway in about 3 or 4 takes.
Mm. And an awful lot of the work with Freddie King was instrumental.
Right.
Would you say that he had those tunes in his head when he came to the
right,
studio?
Right.
And you and the other players at King had not heard any of that material.
Never.
And so Freddie would, in effect, he would play it for you, and then you guys would play it.
That's right. He wanted us to inject our feelings into it. He didn't want to tell us what to play.
Let's talk about in Hideaway specifically. People that know that tune know that it's a very unusual song.
Yeah.
And we've got like a theme that starts out da-da-da-da-da, and everybody's playing a nice shuffle.
Yeah.
And then we've got this choppy little rhythm thing, and then this thing, and it's like it's a bunch of different compartments that are very separate, but the thing really worked. Did you and your fellow players work to come up with those little rhythm changes, or Freddie had that down?
No, he didn't tell us anything. But like I said, he wanted us to inject our feeling into it. I decided to break up that rhythm.
Is that right?
You know, because it sounded like too much shuffling for me. You know, it sounded like too monotonous. And I figured if I break up the rhythm here and come out of this, that would be very exciting. And I told Freddie that, you know, the reason I did that. And he said, "Play whatever you want, man."
Yeah. So we're talking about Balm.
Yeah.
Right. That's fabulous, Phil.
Yeah. And you know, every time it's recorded in this area, they call me to do the recording because they're still trying to get that same feeling that we originally had, you know, which is hard to do.
You
can't copy a feeling. It just has to happen.
Yeah. That's beautiful. You had Sonny Thompson on piano in that session and Bill Willis on bass guitar. And, let's shift gears a little bit, and I know bassist Ed Conley played with you over the years at King Records and a number of gigs afterwards, and you guys had a special friendship.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to us about Ed Conley.
When I came to Cincinnati, the first trio I played with was with Lee Stoller. You know Lee Stoller?
Oh, yeah.
I helped integrate music in Cincinnati.
Racial integration,
When I came to Cincinnati, the black musicians weren't working with the white musicians. And I told them, "I'm from New York. We don't think like that."
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just play music, man. Up until this day, I think the same way. If you can play, I don't care what color you are. And I started working with Lee Stoller. And after I left Lee Stoller, amicably, we're best friends today. I started working with a piano player around town. His name was Woody Evans. We played birthday parties, social events, and all that kind of thing. And Ed Conley was the bassist with Woody Evans. And that's when I met him. And that friendship lasted for 41 years. And whenever I played anywhere and the bass player wasn't adequate, I would make sure to get Ed Conley on the gig. When we started down to the hotel, I was working with a lady piano player, Billy Walker, excellent piano player. And she wanted a bass player. Right away, I mentioned Ed Conley. Then Ed and I, and we'd worked all over the city together. We opened the Playboy Club and with Woody Evans. And we felt each other like brothers. And we made a good rhythm section for any piano player.
You're still playing at the Cincinnati and in downtown, and you released a jazz CD last year. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that CD.
Well, I recorded for Stark Records. It's a doctor. He used to live in over in Alexandria, but he moved to Florida. He suggested we do a live recording, you know. It didn't work too well because I think they wanted to use a lot of individual mics, and it was bleeding. Even the drums were real loud. And I disliked a session where the bass drum is booming, like, you know, so it didn't work. But he brought in an engineer, his partner, who knew how to mic it where the crowd wouldn't interfere with the music. He came back, and we did a second recording, and it came out pretty well.
That's great.
Know? Yeah.
Listen, I know your 90th birthday is coming up August the 11th, and I want to say congratulations on that. I hope you have 90 more.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and there's something sitting there in front of you that in that envelope that I think our listeners might be interested to know about. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, a very good friend of mine had this sent to me. I'll read it to you. It says the White House, Washington. So I guess we all know where that came from. It says, we send our warmest wishes for a happy birthday. You are part of an extraordinary generation that has helped guide America through times of calm and crisis, renewing the values that define our nation. As you celebrate, we hope you reflect with pride on the memories you have made and the lives you have touched. We wish you all the best in the year ahead. Sincerely, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama. I was thrilled to get this, really. I had no idea it was coming. This means a lot to me.
Well, I think it's a sweet greeting, and I know we got a lot of listeners out there that would like to join on the birthday bandwagon and wishing you just all the best on your 90th.
Oh, thank you. I want to thank all of my friends. It's been wonderful here in Cincinnati. This is home to me. You know, I'm from New York, but I long ago adopted Cincinnati as my home because I like the idea of the musical community here. It's just great. I love the people, good musicians, and it's been a great ride.
Phil, you've left your mark not only through the remarkable music that you've made, but also through your really warm heart, and you've touched a lot of people in this town, and we all appreciate it. I've been speaking with Philip Paul, King Records session drummer and jazz musician, who'll be honored Saturday night, August the 8th, at the Cincy Blues Fest. You'll find a link for more information at wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Stuart Holman.